Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B.
Today's guest is Joe Dombrowski. 29 years of combination experience, a captain on Rescue 1 with Stamford Fire Department in Connecticut. The fire service was far from Joe's mind as he was looking at a career in civil engineering or being an architect. His friends were local volunteers and invited Joe to come hang out at the firehouse and see what it was like. After a little bit, one mentioned to Joe to fill out the application and see what it was really about. Hesitant at first, Joe finally did, and once he was able to obtain his Firefighter 1 certification, in his words, was life-changing, because the fire service had never crossed his mind until that moment. In this interview, Joe really brought home solid gems and nuggets that all firefighters should hear, especially if you're involved with recruit training. Not just showing the how, but also reinforcing the why. Joe wasn't quite sure what to expect with coming on board to talk shop, but one thing for sure is he knocked it out the park. With that, I present Joe Dombrowski.
Hey, my name's Joe Dombrowski. I am a career firefighter, 22 years with the Stamford Fire Department, currently assigned to Rescue 1. I recently was on Truck 1 for the past 8 years as a captain. Before that, I was 5 years as a lieutenant. And how I got into the fire service, a big thing is I never thought I was going to be a firefighter. The big thing was I had a lot of friends in high school, and as we were graduating high school, a lot of them were joining volunteer departments. And I never even thought about it, because when I got out of high school, I was looking to be a civil engineer or an architect or something like that. So I was starting to go to school looking down that road. But I was going to a community college because at that time I wasn't the best academically. So I was trying to build up my academics to get into college. A lot of them during our free time were like, come down to the firehouse. We're hanging out all the time. And I was like, eh, I'm not doing much. And then I showed up down there and all my friends were hanging out and they're like, hey, why don't you fill out an application? You come around quite a bit, get into it. And I ended up filling out an application and we started doing some training, got into it a little bit, but was still focused somewhat on school and a little bit on my job. But they had told me you need to get Firefighter 1 to be an interior firefighter. You can't do any interior stuff until you got Firefighter 1. And I took the first Fire 1 class that came out, and it ended up being life-changing for me. It was something I just totally got hooked into. Never thought about it. We did field trips to the firehouses. I always thought they were the coolest people, but never really saw myself as being a firefighter. And I got to say that Firefighter 1 class changed my life. It was everything that I wanted out of life. The changes, the evolving stuff. You always learn something new. It was just exciting stuff. And at the end, you're really helping someone probably in the worst time of their life. Never thought I'd be in that situation, but I sort of got wrapped up into it. It was almost intoxicating. Getting into that Firefighter 1 class. And once I did that, took the class, got my certification, jumped right into Firefighter 2 and got that certification. And that's where I found out that's what I wanted to do for my career. So I ended up starting to test in places. We live right outside the metropolitan area, New York City, but I never really thought of going to the FDNY because by this time in my life, I was probably about 22, 23 years old, and I was just excited where I was. So I started testing for the departments around me that that were given jobs. And honestly, the second test I took, I grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut, took Norwalk's test, and I took Stamford's test, and then I took a couple others, but I ended up getting on Stamford. So I was lucky to get my second shot. Getting hired. I know some guys really struggle to get hired because there's a lot of competition, or there used to be a lot of competition, I should say, because it seems like nowadays the fire service really isn't getting as much attention for job placement as it used to be. Because I remember when we took the test, there were almost 2,000 people taking the test. And now looking today's stuff, I don't know if it's happening around down by you, but we're struggling to get 400 applicants.
Wow.
sometimes. We actually had to put out some recruitment stuff. We did a lot of recruitment stuff this year to try and drum stuff up. But I remember back then it was like 2,000 people sitting in a cafeteria trying to take a test. And I was like, what am I getting myself into? I don't even think I had a chance at the time. But here I am today. And we'll get into it some more.
Okay. All right. With that being said, I'm assuming you went through the testing process. Stanford offered you a job. What was it like when you received the call or the letter back then? And what was it like if you had to go through an academy? What was that like?
We did have to go through an academy. I remember getting the phone call. I was sitting at my old job, I was working for a civil engineering company, so I was sitting at a computer desk, and I got a call from the secretary. And the secretary was funny because the secretary, I grew up with her son, so she knew who I was, and she's like, "You know what I'm calling you for?" And I was like, "Yes, just say I'm gonna say yes." She's like, "Well, I didn't even offer you the job yet." I was like, "Yes, I'll take it." It was an exciting moment. Couldn't believe it happened. I, like everybody else, it's that surreal moment. Like we're here at this point. Was totally excited about it, but I did not expect what I was going to see in the academy. You know, you take fire one, you take fire two, and we weren't a very busy volunteer company. I was in a volunteer company in Rowayton, which is a suburb, a side area district of Norwalk, Connecticut. So we didn't see a lot of calls. Well, you know, you get that fire one, fire two, you think you know a little bit about the fire service. When I went to that fire academy, I realized I didn't know anything about the fire service. It was an exciting moment. Learned a lot of things, and biggest thing I learned is you might have some knowledge, but if you don't have the experience to go with that knowledge, you're really not gonna get you really don't know as much as you think you know. And we did an in-house academy. It was one of the first ones they did after like 6 or 7 years in Stanford. So it was like bringing it back home. We currently do our own academies. We sort of split between the state. Since Connecticut is a smaller state, we only have one state academy. So everybody goes up to the state academy. They have a 14-week program. And you come out of there with all your recruit firefighter certifications. The big thing with our city, we're now the second largest city in Connecticut. We've been growing steadily since I've gotten on the job. We were the fourth largest when I got hired. We're now the second largest in the city. And the big reason behind that is that we are 35 minutes outside of New York City. So the people, especially after COVID happened, there's been a mass exodus out of the city. It seems to be cheaper and you get better living standards in Stanford, and it's a 25, 30-minute commute into the city on the train. So we've seen a big blow up in that. And becoming a bigger department, the city really wanted to bring training back home. So they decided to do the academy back in-house. So we were one of the first groups to do our academy back home. So there was a little controversy because you had some of the people that went up to the state, and they believed that the state was a better academy. But I've always personally thought, even from when we did our academy, when I got hired, that doing in-house training is something. I think you get a better relationship with your firefighters than sending them off. I know some people believe that going off to the state, you don't know anybody, you don't make relationships with your officers or firefighters in the department, so you don't seem as chummy coming on the line. But the thing I liked about it and took away from it when I was going through the academy is you learn the way your department does stuff. And it may not be the best way or the perfect way, but you're learning their way. And when you go to a state academy, you get very generic. They're looking to give you the certifications and get you out. They do a very good job at it, but sometimes you get some differences. And they're really looking at fire one, fire two, doing set skills in the safest manner. We're starting to learn that's not the best way to learn how to do firefighting. And that's what I picked up from our academy is that we spent a lot of time this is how Stanford does it. This is what we expect out of you. This is what we want you to do. This is what we want you to look out for. And they took some elements of Fire One, right? Because we all have to get those certifications, but they also took the elements of this is what you need to do on the job to get your job done. And I really, really like that getting into our academy when I first started. And I'll tell you, the first couple of weeks, though, I was like, what did I get myself into? Because, I mean, they pushed us right into there. They pushed us right in with the air packs. We had a maze, right? And everybody tests their claustrophobia. And there's that moment where you're like, do I really want to do this or not? I stuck through it. We had really good instructors. We had a captain who ended up becoming the fire chief of the department who ran our academy, and a couple other guys. They did a real good job of getting us through everything and building our skills. And it sort of set the foundation for me to help with teaching, because the way they taught and the way they helped get us through obstacles, it was something I wanted to do. And I was always told by a few instructors, the best way to learn the job is also to help teach the job too. I know the late Bill Gustin was a big advocate of that. If you could bring some stuff back home and teach it, it helps reinforce that into your skills. And I think that's how I got into teaching, is because we did our own academy in-house. And I got to not only learn from the guys I worked with, but I also got to see how they nurtured us and helped build us up. And that's, I believe in that a lot with the fire service, is you can't just point your finger and say, this is where you got to go, but you got to nurture those people and give them the why. Especially now, everybody's thirsty for the why do we do that. And one thing I've always discredited, and I don't discredit the person, but we've gotten to things where we learn how to do stuff, and we're like, well, why do we do it that way? Mm-hmm. And their comment is, that's the way we've always done it.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of, I don't really buy into what you're saying much anymore, because you need to know the why. And there's a lot of guys out there that are really starting to teach the why. You're starting to see it come out a lot more, is why do we do the things we do? When do we do the things we do? And those are the cues that you need to really send home. It was always like, this is the way we do it. Don't question the way we do it.
And, right.
But why? Why? That's what I really saw with that. So I try to teach, break down the whys and how do we do stuff, and get into those elements of doing your job properly. Not only how to do your job, but what cues you'd offer to make a decision. Because that's the thing I sort of felt coming up as an officer. We did do one academy, a fire officer academy, but after that, when I became a lieutenant, there was really no officer training. Once you passed the lieutenant's test, you got on what they called the eligibility list. And once they established the eligibility list, you started acting in that position. We don't have a driver operator promotion. We go from firefighter to lieutenant. And lieutenant was something we didn't have up until the 90s. We only had captains. So we go to lieutenant, then you go to captain, and then we have a deputy chief, which sort of revolves around more like a battalion chief for some places. We have two deputy chiefs and then an assistant chief and a chief. So you sort of work your way up that way. Mm-hmm. But once you got on that lieutenant's list, like, here you go. You're acting here in the front seat.
Right.
And it was quite the wake up call. There wasn't a whole lot. We had some good officers. My captain was on the rescue as a firefighter. So I had a captain who is now a deputy chief. He did take me under his wing and started grooming me for those things. But at the end of the day, you were just in the front seat starting to make decisions. And you didn't always get the how to make a decision or why to make the decision. And I did get a lot of help from my senior guy, too. We had a guy, Scotty Gill. Not stand-up guy, one of the best senior guys that I ever worked with in my career. And it was kind of funny as a joke, because as soon as you sat in that front seat, he looked at you and was like, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut. I was like, wait. And we went on a couple calls, did our thing, but he really helped me a lot. Little cues here and little cues there. And that was the original senior guy was a guy that kept the house in line, but he also helped everybody to make sure they succeeded. And he was one of the people that helped me the most, because I went on some calls not even having a clue on some of the stuff that I had to do. Like, we had a lady that tripped over a sidewalk, and he's like, "Hey, you should call the police out here because it's city property," and the lady tripped on her face. Now, he could have been a grumpy guy and never told me any of that, but he really took it to heart and make sure that we knew our job too, not just, even though we were going a rank above him, he made sure that everybody succeeded. Okay. He was really a stand-up guy. Kept you in place when he needed to, but he made sure you knew your job and knew what you had to do. And we'd have our little spats in the firehouse, everybody does, but he'd stand up for you right to the end all the time.
Okay. For those that don't know, including myself, can you tell us a little bit about Stanford, the size, how many personnel stations, things of that nature?
Okay. Yeah, Stanford, we're, like I said, the second largest city in Connecticut. We're about 40, 50 miles east of New York City. So we're in what they call that New York metropolitan area. So we do get a lot of people that come out of New York City. In fact, a good portion of our population is people that live in Stanford and actually commute into the city. We used to be an industrial city. We did have a lot of factories back in the early 1900s up until about the 1970s, 1980s. And then companies started moving out. There was that mass exodus of industry, sort of going to cheaper places. But we always had New York City as that buffer. While other cities sort of started to decline, we sort of kept building because a lot of people were finding out that they had better, they got more bang for their buck with their money living in Stanford than they were living in New York City. Because anybody that goes to New York City knows it's a very expensive place to live. And they look at living in a small, old apartment in New York City with no amenities to come into Stanford. You get a bigger apartment. You get they have concierge service. They have gyms. They have dog walking services. They even rent out places that are fully furnished. So we've been getting a massive influx of people from New York City living in Stanford. So we've seen a huge population growth where when I got hired, we were about 120,000 people in the city. Now we're crossing up into the 150 mark at 20 years later. Mm-hmm. We've been one of the few departments in the state that's actually been growing in personnel. When I first got hired there, now we're a combination department. A lot of people don't know that. Years ago, back in the 1950s, there used to be the city of Stanford and the town of Stanford, where the town of Stanford was a volunteer system and the city of Stanford was a career system. And they incorporated, I think it was 1947, so we became one city, but we did maintain the volunteer districts. And we call them the Big Five. We have five different volunteer companies in the city. And they ran what was the town of Stanford, and the city ran the downtown area. As years went on, population grew. The volunteers started having trouble responding to all their calls. So they actually started hiring personnel. Over the years, again, population grew. They got to a point where they had enough members in their volunteer districts that were career firefighters that they actually unionized and became part of our union. I think that was first in 1997. And I mean, we could go on hours talking about the volunteer and career system in Stanford. But now today, we've actually expanded. When I got hired, we actually only had 6 engines, 3 trucks, and a heavy rescue and 1 deputy chief. Now today, 20 years later, we have 9 engines, still 3 trucks, 1 heavy rescue, and 2 deputy chiefs, which sort of split the district north and south. But we still have the volunteer component, and they still augment the system. They're sort of independent of each other, but they do all fall under the direction of our chief. It was a charter revision we had back in 2012 where we made it one full department. Because before that, the relationship was a little bit scattered. You had the volunteer side, you had the career side. There were some personalities, button heads, but they were operating independent of each other. Today we operate under one chief. Chief Robert Morris is our chief now. And we actually have a assistant chief that is in charge of the volunteer services and assistant chief that's in charge of the career services. So we've sort of meld them together into one. So even though we have 9 engines, 3 trucks, and a rescue, we actually have a lot more resources than that with the volunteer systems. And those vary depending on where they are, how much membership they have, and the systems could be very inconsistent with who shows up where. But we do work well together with them. We've been building a relationship since 2012. They do a lot of our water supply stuff because we're the crazy thing about Stamford is we're so close to New York City. We're about 40 square miles, and we have everything from a dense urban district downtown where you go into the middle third. We're actually like a narrow and tall city, like a rectangle. So the lower third of the city is urban population. The middle third of the city is a suburban kind of atmosphere. And the upper third is, I wouldn't say rural because there's not many farms in Stamford, but it is a, there are areas where you have no water supply, where we have, even as big a city as we are, and with the systems we have, there are sections of the city that do not have any hydrants in them. So we actually rely on water tankers to actually supply water to those areas. So we're a very diverse city. Big thing too is we have the Northeast Corridor. So we have I-95 that runs through us, the Metro North trains. So we're seeing thousands of people come through the city every day, just either commuting or working in the city. I always like to, we always talk about it, like we're like industry left. And when people say, well, what goes on in Stamford? I'm like, our industry is residential. Is everybody's coming in residential and office space. You see a lot of Fortune 500 companies moving into Stamford. Again, the proximity to New York City. They have all the benefits and resources here, but they're also in close proximity to New York City where they get in there and do office stuff or business down in the city too. So we have a big diversity of that. We have a shoreline also, and that was something we didn't have when I first got hired, is we did not have a marine division. So we've actually developed a marine division. We currently have 2 boats. One is staffed by Engine 4. We designated 4 company as the marine unit, and then the other one is just an ancillary unit that's put in the water by Station 1, which is headquarters.
And do you still have active volunteers to this day?
Yes, we still have the 5 volunteer districts. They all vary. They're different size districts, but we do have two departments that cover a larger portion of the city, and they tend to have the higher memberships. And guys float around from that, depending on what they're looking to get out of it. But it is a good farm system too. I do have to agree. We have pulled a lot of members from our volunteer system. Because they do get a benefit taking our test. They get residency points if they live in the city taking the test, but they also get points for being a volunteer in good standing. So there is a benefit. So if you got military experience, you got a volunteer in Stanford and you're a resident, you get a pretty good benefit points wise when you take the test.
And then I'm assuming too, like when it comes to calls, the volunteers can respond alongside with the career guys.
Yeah, so they actually dispatch us together when we get sent out. They can staff their units, but they have to meet certain criteria for EMT and an officer. And they have to have so many people on for a certain time frame where they can actually go in as a staff unit. That doesn't happen too often because a lot of them have to be committed to the firehouse. And sometimes they're jumping in and out. And that's just because they got busy lives, it's a lot of stuff going on. So we don't see a lot of staffed units, but they do get dispatched to us just like a regular volunteer company does. They respond to the firehouse and they'll usually get a unit out. Depending on what the call is and how busy it is, some of them may not go on every call, but a few of them, I'd say good portion of them make just about every call that we go on. They might get one rig out, they may get a whole crew out, but they're definitely there to help us out. Sometimes they get there before us. Sometimes we get there before them, but we try to work together as best we can. And we even put things in place with the new deputy chief we put in service. They also put a volunteer accountability officer. And what that does is puts one of the volunteer officers at the command post, not only to help them with stuff at the command post, but also to help for accountability to volunteers. Because one of the biggest problems we have is volunteers just showing up, and we
Nobody
don't
know.
tend, we may not put them to work because who are you? Where's your accountability tags? Where can we put you in the system? So we actually have an accountability officer that responds to every structure fire in the volunteer districts, and that's their job is to help account for the volunteers. But they're pretty good about coming to the command post and getting their assignments. And because we do a lot of predetermined assignments. I mean, I know guys talk about blue card and a bunch of other stuff. We don't follow blue card, but we're a very SOP driven department. So every first due engine has an assignment, second due engine has assignment, and so on and so forth. So we all have our assignments, and sometimes they don't incorporate the best into that, but we do try to get them assignments based on how they arrive, when they arrive, and the amount of people they come with.
And as far as your career staffed apparatus, what's your minimum staffing across the board there between the engines and the trucks?
So when I first got hired, we were four across all the engines, four on the rescue. And then engine trucks two and three only had three people. So when I first got hired, there were only three people on truck two and truck three. The contract negotiations, we actually got that up to four man staffing. Because the way we used to be is, remember I said before we talked about we only had captains, no lieutenants up until the 90s. Those lieutenants actually went on to the trucks. The trucks used to have no officers at all. It was just the most senior guys in the department, and they were under the discretion direction of the incident commander. So they basically got put to work by the incident commander, and so they always stuck the most senior guys on that rig to take care of that work. But once we started incorporating lieutenants, they put lieutenants on all the trucks, but they traded off and didn't put a fourth on trucks two and three. So when I got hired, we went up to four man staffing on trucks two and three. And then when we did the merger with the volunteers, we opened engine companies eight and nine, and they only had three man staffing on those for a couple of years. And we were able to negotiate four man staffing on all those apparatus. So now we have four person staffing on all apparatus across the city, and our deputies actually also have a driver, so they're not driving alone, which is a big advantage. I hear guys driving to calls by themselves, and it's got to be overwhelming just to try and control all that stuff and get a board set up. So we actually do have deputies aides that help the deputies at the command post, which is a huge benefit to them because you're trying to run the incident, trying to get accountability, trying to get benchmarks. And you don't have time to set all that stuff up. So that aide runs around, gets the accountability set up, talks to dispatch for him, and gets a lot of the side work done that that incident commander needs.
And I know you mentioned that you guys don't have like a dedicated driver's position. So how do you rotate, or how do you equate for the driver's role? Is it by seniority, or is it like rotated on a weekly basis, monthly?
So the way driving's done in the city of Stamford is we bid, people can bid on a spot. So the criteria you have to have is it used to be that you just had to take the department written test, get certified and broken in by an officer, and then you were eligible to get in on an apparatus. Now we sort of changed that a little bit. You could take a department test, but what we're seeing most people now is they will accept the state pump operator certificate. Because that was years ago where you could just take the test and pass and be broken in and be fine. But now, taking the state pump operator classes is a prerequisite to getting on a pump, getting a driving job. And once you used to have to have a Q, one thing our department did is they made that you have a CDL. And I know Q isn't a thing. Some people are probably asking, well, what is a Q? Is Connecticut's one of the few states that has an endorsement on your license to drive fire apparatus specifically. So what a Q endorsement is, and the state used to give the class. Now the municipalities, the AHJs, can actually give the Q class and certify people. So basically, you give like an EVOC course, do a driving test, and that department can actually sign you off, and you could go to the DMV and get a Q endorsement on your license. You usually have one designee in the department who signs that, and then you get a Q endorsement that gives you the right to operate fire apparatus in the state of Connecticut. Which is nice because you look at some places, some states have no requirements. Like you just need to have an operator's license and you could drive a fire apparatus. It was a nice bridge because it shows that you had some kind of formal education for driving heavy vehicles. But our department has taken it one step further, is to be an assigned driver, you actually have to have a commercial driver's license. Which really narrowed the pool down because the commercial driver's license test is a lot more in depth than the Q class. Q class sort of was just like the driving portion of the CDL without the written portion. We sort of focused the written portion on the pump operator, which is separate from the Q. It's a state certificate. But now, to be an assigned driver in the Stanford Fire Department, you actually have to have a CDL, which really ups the requirements because now not only do you have to pass a test, you actually have to meet the medical standards to drive for the DOT. So it's been a big change. I know we've talked about just going back to a Q because it's very hard for some people to get the CDL or get access to the CDL because it's a big class to run. But we actually just put a class of 20 through a CDL and they're all testing this upcoming time. But you had to have a CDL to be an assigned driver, but you could drive as a relief driver with a Q endorsement. So we had those things. But that was basically bid on based on seniority. If you met all those criteria, you bid on a driving job. If you were the most senior person, you got the job. And that's how we worked. And we've talked about changing policies. But we have other things. Everything in the department, there's multiple things going on. And it works. It's a work in progress, too.
So how long did it take for you to start moving up the ranks, like to an officer's position, and why?
The why is I like being involved in stuff, I like being able to make some of the decisions. Saw how some people were being treated, didn't really like it. And you always feel like you could do a good job doing that or show your interest in making a change in the department for the better, bringing people together. That's probably what drove me to taking the test. But our department, you had to have 5 years on as a firefighter before you could take a lieutenant's test. And actually, when I first got hired, you could actually take the captain's test with 8 years on. So there were a few individuals in our department that went straight from firefighter to captain. Since then, we've gotten away from that and we went to a step system. So you still have to have 5 years on before you could even take a lieutenant's test, but you also have to maintain your EMT, and you have to have fire instructor one to take a lieutenant's test. And once you take that lieutenant's test, you are eligible to act, which is nice because now you get some acting time before you get promoted. Once you get promoted to that, then you can take the captain's test. I think you have to be a lieutenant for 1 year in that position before you could actually are eligible to take the captain's test. And to take the captain's test, you also have to have fire officer one, which once you get promoted to lieutenant, that's a requirement to maintain your lieutenant's position. You actually have to have a fire officer one within, I think it is a 1 or 2 year period that you have to get fire officer one. And if you don't get that, you'll end up getting demoted. And that was something we recently did. I want to say it goes back to 2016, where we actually changed that officers had to have officer certifications in the fire department. And it was always funny because before that, there was no requirements. And of course, when you get on the job, you got to go run around. You want to take every class that you can. And I had a couple years on the job, and the department had opened up instructor one and officer one and jumped in on all those classes. And there were a couple officers that were like, why don't you get some time on the job before you take those classes? Mm-hmm. When we changed our policies and went to have fire officer classes, he found out those same individuals were taking those fire officer classes to get into their positions. Okay. So it was a big change in the department giving guys. I mean, we had some great officers, but it set the stage for having that education at those levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had some of the best officers I ever knew were officers that didn't even have fire officer classes, but we didn't have any standards to really get us to where we are today. And it's been a big change because guys now have a standardized process to go through. Okay. And then to go from captain to deputy chief, you had to be captain for 2 years before you take the deputy chief's test. Plus you have to have fire officer two to maintain your position as a captain. And then for deputy chief, you have to get fire officer three within, I think, 2 years of getting promoted.
Okay.
So we really changed our structure for our officers, which I think it's been a much better benefit to the department.
Okay. Do you guys have some sort of company officer development classes now, or is that something you're working on?
We've had them intermittently. Sometimes when we promote, we only promote one or two people at a time. In fact, there's a promotional interview going on tonight where they're going to be promoting one lieutenant and one captain. But we have had bands where we had a lax in promotions. Some were due to lawsuits. Some were due to not getting testing done right away, where we promoted 20 to 30 officers in one clip. And, a couple times the department did at that time make like a fire officer academy, but we have nothing set in stone as far as doing an in-house fire officer academy. We've talked about it, and you know, sometimes the things don't align, the planets don't align at the right time to get those things in place. Mm-hmm. But we do officer development on a regular basis. They will try to bring in outside people. Like we've had Turpac. We just recently had Champo come in for a truck operations class. So we do try to bring in outside people to sort of foster that officer development stuff. But we do really focus on just getting them their officer certifications at this time.
Okay. All right. And there's nothing wrong with bringing in some outside people. I actually think a lot more departments should do that. Bringing in somebody that's not from within that can bring a different perspective, that breath of fresh air for other company officers to be like, oh, I never thought about that.
Yeah. And we've always, I've done the last, back in 2021, I was asked if I would like to do the fire academy, which was funny because it was full circle, because when I had gotten hired, when I was in the academy, the captain that ran our academy was now the chief of the department. Mm-hmm. And him coming through the training division asking if I was interested in running the academy, it was like it came full circle back to where I started. So I did jump in on that, and I ended up running the last four fire academies for the department. But one of the things we did, and I'll talk a little bit about the stuff in the academy, but one of the things we talked about with the new recruits is get outside of this department. Don't get stuck in the bubble of your own city. And it's very easy, right? We go on calls every day. We work in our own city. So we sort of get stuck in this bubble of, this is what happens at Stanford. Don't worry about what goes on in South Carolina. Don't worry about what goes on in New York City. Because there were times you go and take a class and you come back and you say, hey, I learned this in class. Well, we're not going to do that here. That happened outside. And I'm sure that happens everywhere you go. But a lot of times that information is so valuable to bring back. And even if you don't take everything, bring something back. So one of the things we did in our academy is we tell kids, we tell the new recruits, get outside of this place, get an education outside of here, not just Stanford Fire Department, but outside the Connecticut, right? Because it's a very small state, so we don't get a lot of outside influence when you just take Connecticut classes and you just take Stanford Fire Department training. You got to go outside this place and bring in a lot of new stuff. And it's frustrating because sometimes it's not well accepted right off the bat. You
Right.
just have to be per you just have to stick with it. But talking to them about it, we talk about our education. We all know none of us made any of this stuff up. We learned it from other people. Nobody's really invented anything in the fire service in a really long time. It's taking it from other places and adapting it to what your needs are. So one thing we do during the academy is we hinge on them getting an education abroad and bringing stuff back to the department and what works, works, and what doesn't, doesn't. But what we did is we actually went on the whiteboard and we wrote down every mentor we've had, every book that we've gotten information out of, everybody that you should be listening to outside of the department. And we actually filled up an entire whiteboard with over 100 names. And we sort of said, like, this is where my decisions came from. I don't make all this stuff up, but all these people behind us here, that's where we were influenced from. These are our mentors. These are the people we're getting information to, and we're sharing it with everybody. The best thing you could do is go to a class. Even if you spent $25 on a class and you learned one thing from that class, I feel it's totally worth that class. But our focus was getting them in a mindset of just thinking about stuff, when to do stuff, and cues. I always said in our academy, the biggest theme I always had is when your IQ goes up, let me take that back. When your stress level goes up, your IQ tends to go down.
That's right.
And we worked a lot on stress inoculation and resilience. And you don't learn that on your own. You got to learn that outside this place, reading books, going over stuff. And we really hinged a lot of it on stress inoculation, making decisions, what decisions to make, because it could be overwhelming too. You show them all this information you get. What are we doing in an academy? You plop down like six books in front of them, and every book is about 3 inches thick. And the last thing you're thinking is like, I got to retain all this information. And knowledge is a good thing, but knowledge without the experience is just knowledge.
That's right.
I think you had Pressler on recently. He said it was just theory, right? When it was only when you only have the knowledge. And he's 100% right. And you got to relate knowledge to experience. And on the flip side too, is you could have a lot of people with experience but no knowledge. And I think that's what went back to when I said before is that's when people say that's the way we always did it. Why did we do it? Maybe that's not the best way. Let's try looking this way. You may not agree with me right off the bat, but let's practice with it. Because I think my opinion is we got to treat fire departments like professional athletic teams. And you're never going to get there just by doing the class once and not doing it. I mean, you look at baseball, and I'll always refer to baseball because that was my thing as a kid. A hockey, boxing, any sport you go to, what do those athletes do every single day?
Practice.
Baseball player will hit off a tee 150 times a day to work on his skills. So how do you, as a firefighter, stretch a hose line for 3 weeks and think you're all of a sudden a firefighter? Right? Those are skills we got to work on all the time, nonstop. Bringing new information, bringing new techniques. We should always be evolving. And I'm not saying go out and rewrite your policies every couple of years, but the little tactics and the little tips and tricks that you learn from people is really what helps you make you do your job and be able to do it right. So like I said, you could get a lot of knowledge, but if you don't have the experience to back it up, it's just knowledge,
Yeah.
right? That understanding really comes from putting the experience together with the knowledge and seeing when does this work, when does this not work, right? The theories apply themselves or don't apply themselves at those times.
Definitely, definitely.
And we really hinge on that a lot. Big thing with the stress is that's where I've seen a lot of other people have problems too, is we spent a lot of time in the academy on air. I think if you ask some of our guys, they spent probably a good half the day in the first few weeks on air. Because you could have all the knowledge in the world. You could have all, and experience will help this, but you could have all the knowledge in the world, be the toughest guy. But if your heart rate's too high at a call, you might not going to make any decisions at all. And we worked a lot on stress inoculation. I know Rick George does a lot of
stress inoculation.
Really good resource to tie into. One book, and it was actually one of our officers that became a chief. We were sort of in parallel lines, but we weren't talking to each other about it. And he had asked me when I did the first academy, he's like, hey, can I do a resiliency class with the recruits right at the beginning? Because he was also doing our military bearing. He was teaching them how to salute, how to march. He's like, I want to do a development class with them on resilience. And it was funny because he started talking in the class and we were on the same exact path. And one book that really changed the way I viewed it was Colonel Grossman. I don't know if you've read On Combat.
I've heard of it.
Great book to read about the psychology of being able to make decisions in stressful situations. He revolves it a lot around the police, law enforcement, and military, but it definitely applies to the fire service. And he talks about condition black and condition red and condition yellow. And Chief Kerwin at the time, he did that class and he was writing Colonel. I'm like, this guy is like, it's like my love language with that stuff. And I think it changed the way our recruits handled stuff. Because when I was in the academy, you sort of just got yelled at. Mm-hmm. Put your face mask on, get in there. And we had some instructors that were great, but there were some instructors that just wanted to yell at you, get in there, get amped up, heart rate's high, you're struggling. And then you'd see some you see a lot of failures, and you see a lot of people break with frustration because they couldn't get past that. What we tried to do with our academies is we try to build up that. And we did it with the air packs by not bringing them to a stress level and then bringing them back down. We want them to work on that and recognize, hey, are you having a problem here? Because I think one of the worst things you could do at the beginning of a recruit academy is have a recruit that rips their face piece off. I'm sure you've seen that before. I've seen it. There was one incident, and this is probably where I got my itch to never listen, letting a pass alarm go by. We were in a Fire One class, and I was doing victim drags with a group, and another officer was doing SCBA. I heard a pass alarm going off. And what we used to do is if your team broke up, you set off someone's pass alarm. All your accountability, you got to be with your guy. Well, I heard that pass alarm continue to go off. And I was like, let me see what's going on. And as we walked over there, the other officer was walking up to that individual. His partner looked at us with dish saucers for eyes in his mask. And he's like, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on. Meanwhile, his partner is face first into the ground. He had sucked, hyperventilated through his mask and went into respiratory arrest.
Oh,
just crawling around in an open space. They were just told crawl because we were past the point. We were doing 45 second drills. We were past that. Now it's like, okay, just crawl around the drill tower, go up the stairs. Well, he sucked through his bottle. And when we pulled his mask off, his face was blue and he had foam coming out of his mouth. Luckily, in about 10 seconds, just before we were about to check for a pulse, he came to, took a deep breath in, color came back. We almost had heart attacks. We were like, what happened? He's like, well, I was crawling around. He's like, I just started daydreaming and I woke up.
Huh.
And here I was. And we think his stress level was so, his heart rate was so high, his mind just went off into that far path.
Right.
What's going on? So you ever hear me at a fire scene and I hear a pass alarm go off, I will hunt that down and make sure it's not going
off. Okay.
But that was where we really need to build people's stress up slowly. You can't just jump them into this and expect them to totally make decisions. So a lot of our academy, the first couple of weeks, we sort of build up on that. Introduce you to the air pack, get you comfortable with the air pack, put it on, take it off. We all know that same drill. There's reasons behind all that stuff. But we'd get them into the maze, right? Get you to a level. And I'm a fan of having those face shields that come off on the outside. I know people like to wear the wax paper on the inside or the foam on the inside. But the biggest thing with stress is if you give somebody their vision back and look at us face to face and you're going to be okay, they could calm down. When you don't have that ability, I feel like their only option is to take their face mask off. And with that, I think you need that stress inoculation and build up on that skill. And we would do that in our academy the first couple of weeks. Take them in the maze and you could hear people, hey, listen to your breathing, relax. We actually would have them go into spots where we would have them play a game of Simon. Remember that game with the lights and trying to figure stuff out? Because you can't put them on hard skills right off the bat. You got to build them up slowly. And playing like a game of Connect Four in the dark, we put blue tape over the flashlight so you can't see what color you got. That's enough stress mentally to build them up, but it also helps. It's a game. So to them, it's taking their mind away from their stress a little bit. And we can watch them and let them focus on a task and build up that skill and work their way up. It worked out really well. And then we got to a point where we'd actually bring in sound too. You start hearing sounds and a lot of things get missed and you sort of drowned out background sounds, right? And we want people to be that situational awareness. So one thing we would do is while they were going through the maze, doing stuff and we're talking to them, we'd play background music and we'd play sounds and we'd play like funny sounds. We'd play fire ground sounds like chainsaws going or people calling for help or radio chatter in the background. But one thing we would also do with that for situational awareness and that stress, like, hey, take your mind out of this and reset and put yourself back in the game, is we'd play a Mayday while they were doing their searches. Wouldn't say anything to anybody. And when you get done with your search, say, what did you guys hear? And they'd always say, oh, we heard the chicken dance, or we heard AC/DC playing, or we heard the chainsaws. We heard all these things. And I'm like, well, how many people heard the Mayday? And only a couple people would raise their hands. I'm like, that's your stress making you focus on those things. And it's funny. You always do this stuff and you're like, is it hitting home? Is it really making a difference? And we've had a couple guys come back and they're like, my stress got to me today at a call. And we had a call, a pretty bad truck accident. It was a box truck and a dump truck. And one of the recruits who's now a firefighter, he's like, it was just like what you said. He's like, I had the struts in my hand, but my hands, he's like, I know how to put them together, but my hands wouldn't physically put them together. Everything was there. The knowledge was there, right? But what did he not have? He had to control his stress and he had to just take a couple deep breaths, was able to get it together and get it focused. I feel like I'm going off in a little rabbit hole with you.
No, you're good.
But I think that was missed by a lot of training, the stress inoculation. And I know Rick George really hits you. Anybody that is looking in stress inoculation, look that guy up. He's got some real good information on resiliency and focus and situational awareness. There's a lot of other guys out there too, but you really have to incorporate that into your academy. Because if you build them up with fear, they're just going to be afraid their whole career.
That's right.
You got to remind them, hey, it's going to be all right. Get your heart rate down. And actually, I know you guys aren't seeing this, but I wear a whoop band. I'm sure I've seen a few guys wearing them. And I actually look at my heart rate, whether we're doing training, whether we went to a fire, what I did during that training, what I did during that fire. Did I lose my temper? And I find out my trigger is like 170 beats per minute, which is pretty much almost 100% of my capacity. But I find if I start losing focus, heart rate.
Yeah.
And we got to really teach guys how to control your heart rate. One, I mean, the best thing obviously is physical fitness, diet, taking care of yourself, but you could mentally lower your heart rate too. And a lot of times it's not your physical aspect that's driving up your heart rate.
It's that, yep.
It's your mind. It's your mind up at the top.
Yeah.
And there's times where I find if I start getting loud on the radio, I try not to talk loud on the radio. And in fact, I tell people a fire scene should be sound like it's a calm, normal day. We're all professionals. If you're yelling on the radio every 10 seconds, sounds like the building's coming down. It's telling me a couple things. Number one, your heart rate and your stress level are so high. Where's your decision making? And sometimes it goes back to the boy that cried wolf. If you're the screamer on the radio all the time, when something's actually bad, somebody might ignore that as, oh, he's just yelling all the time.
Right.
It should be calm, relaxed, just like we're having a conversation now is the way we should be having it on the radio. And that comes down to training. You're not going to learn that at a call, right? That's the worst place to learn it. A guy doesn't figure out how to knock somebody out when he gets into the boxing ring with his opponent. He works on those skills for the days and years beforehand. And we should be working on those skills too. Everybody just focuses on putting the ladder up, stretching the hose line. But think about what you're saying on the radio. Your demeanor, your thoughts on the radio help you get that reset. And I talked to some of the, we do some of the live fire training that we do. And it's funny because we talk about the strategy and tactics we're trying to push in the skill. But I'm like, at the same time, like, use your benchmark as a way to reset yourself. Like, we always push, like, you got to say water on a fire. You got to say fire is knocked down. You got to say search is complete. But don't take that as just, because some people say, oh, yeah, I got to talk on the radio all the time. And I'm not a fan of having huge conversations on the radio. Let the firefighters be firefighters. But the incident commander at times does need that update of what's completed and what's done. Take it as a reset. Hey, water on the fire. Because as an officer, right, we could become that tunnel vision just because of our stress level alone. Saying water on the fire sort of makes me reset and pull myself back. Okay, let me pull myself back for a little bit and see what's going on around me. And that's your own benchmark.
Definitely. Definitely. Okay. With that being said, I'm going to ask you, what, in your opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
It's funny because I've been thinking about this for a while. And I think I want to say aggressive, right? We usually equate aggressive to fighting, right? Some kind of violence or fighting. And it is in our name, right? Firefighting. Aggressive. And I think we like to tie that in. What aggressive fire, he's an aggressive, or she's an aggressive firefighter. I think I don't need to say we need to get away from it, but it's, I think people attach it to something bad. Like, people don't want to say aggressive anymore. I'm cool with saying aggressive. But it's that person that's prepared for the game. It's having, being ready, that stress resilience, that area of being always enthusiastic, being, it doesn't mean you're just recklessly going in there. You have a game plan, you've practiced, and you're ready to go. Like I said, probably aggressive is not the best term for that. I like going back to being, are you the, oh my God, firefighter, or oh, thank God, firefighter? And I would think my perspective, that aggressive firefighter is that, oh, thank God. And what I mean by that is when you have someone show up at a fire, are you saying, oh, thank God they're here, things are going to get better, or, right, oh my God, we better buckle up for this one.
Right.
Because we don't know what's going on. But that person is coming in enthusiastic, wants to be a part of the team. And that's another thing. You have to be part of the team. There's not one of us out here that's going to put a fire out by ourselves or going to take that person out of the car by themselves. There's a reason we send 26 firefighters to an initial fire response. It's because we all need to be a part of that to make a difference. And you're coming in there knowing that you have a specific assignment to do. You've spent the time training and preparing for that. and you're in that mindset of getting that task done and being part of the bigger picture. I think that's my mind what an aggressive firefighter is. That firefighter knows their limits, what they can push themselves to, and hedge their bets on what they need to push themselves to. They might do an extraordinary thing, but they know that level of confidence that they have, and that comes through training. There's no one sitting on the couch that's going to become an aggressive firefighter, or the, oh, thank God, firefighter, I should say. But that gets through training, and that gets working on skills. And you got to work on specific skills too. It's not just an overall thing. And that's something we've really pushed forward in our training. Is we started doing live fire training. Chief Morris likes to refer to it as Monday Fun Day. The reason we do it on Mondays is because our live burn building is right next door to the transfer center for the public garbage. So they're closed on Mondays because we usually smoke them out any other day of the week. So we've designated Mondays as Monday Fun Day, and we work on live fire training. So what we do is we bring in three companies in the morning, three companies in the afternoon, and we work on specific skills. And I know there's a lot of different avenues with live fire training. Mm-hmm. And some people like to focus it on, let's just respond to the call. Everybody do their first due assignments, and we work on that skill. But what are you really getting out of that? Is there times where it's good to do that? Yes, absolutely. And going back to professional athletes, what do professional athletes spend more of their time doing? Do they spend more time scrimmaging, or do they spend more time working on specific tactics and skills? Right, you think about that. Scrimmaging is good, but at the same time, you got to focus on a specific skill. So what we did with our live fire training is we geared it towards a specific task. Like the first ones we did is just first line in operation. We're not responding in. The rig's already parked there, already positioned in place. You're going to pull the hose line, first line off, stage outside the door, stretch to the fire, put the fire out. There was no like truck work being done. There was no, we do a little size up stuff, but there was no like hooking up to the hydrant. None of that stuff. We worked on that one skill so everybody could focus on that skill. And we worked on that, and we kept it to the company. Remember when I said back when we had officers, when I went to the academy, it was like, put the fear in you. And they wanted to find any reason that you made a mistake and make everybody else know, don't make that mistake. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening, that you got guys that didn't want to do anything because they were afraid to make a mistake in front of people.
Right.
It's okay to make mistakes. If we make them on the training ground, that's where we should be making our mistakes, is on the training ground, not on the fire. Do we make mistakes on the fire ground? Absolutely. But we need to keep those to a minimum. But we need to focus on our skills and what we're doing. So we do our training. And one thing we found a benefit of is, yeah, one company would stretch their line, get it in operation. One company would be in rehab. And what we did with the third company is put them in as observation. Because one thing no one ever gets to do at a live fire training is to observe what goes on in the fire building. Right? You're either on the engine company, you're on the truck company doing a search, you're on the rescue doing a search, you're doing ventilation. No one ever puts you in that position. Just, hey, just sit in this corner. We'll give you a bunch of thermal imaging cameras and just watch the other companies come in. It did a few things for us, and it was well received. Does a few things for us. Number one, it gives you that time to get somewhat heat saturated, right? When you're just doing an engine company operation, the person that probably sees any heat is the guy in the nozzle. And if he's doing his job right, it shouldn't be taking that much of a beating, because if you're putting water in the spots where we have heat, you shouldn't be feeling a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. Truck, you're going to feel some heat if you're doing a search in front of the hose line or head or over the fire. But the guy in the back really didn't get to feel much. He really didn't get to see much either, except pull some hose and just do the drill. So he didn't pick up a ton of stuff except what he specifically did on that task. So what we did is we took the third company and we put them in that spot to sit there. They actually, some of them would light the fire with us, and we use it as an opportunity for fire behavior, a little fire development. Like, listen, we're sort of in the spot where the victim was when the fire started. So you get to see all that development happened, how we went from a cool room to a hot room, get yourself a little heat saturation, uncomfortableness, but you also get to watch the engine company come in and actually stretch their line, work around the corners, water mapping, flowing water down the hallway, flowing water on the fire, seeing what actually works. And they got to sit there and observe it and watch it. And we've had huge feedback on that, where guys are learning a lot of stuff. And we actually got the seat cameras that have the recordable thermal imaging. So what we do at the end of the drill is all our instructors that were in the burn building would set themselves up with that last 20 feet of the stretch before you got to the fire room. We'd record all those, and then we'd send them to the company officer that was at that drill. So now they could go back to the firehouse, sit there and watch what they did and actually see those skills. And we've gotten huge feedback. In fact, with the end of the winter season, we've gotten away from live burns because we got freezing temperatures coming.
Yeah.
You guys are asking, when are we doing live burns again? When are we doing live burns again? It's because they get to work on that specific skill. In fact, we did single line stuff and we went to two line stuff. And now we were focusing on 2.5 inch, and we just finished up basement fires. And we talked about it, like, you could focus on the basement fire itself. What signs you know you have a basement fire? We talk about ventilation. We show them fire development, right? That observation crew now gets to see a basement fire from its ignition phase to fully developed going up the stairs, and then get to watch an engine company flow water down the stairs. And ultimately, our goal was to have them come down the stairs. But we tell them that's usually your last resort, right? You had no exterior access. You have no other way of getting in that basement. You couldn't get water in through a window. Your last resort is really to have to make that push down the stairs. And guys got to actually see how flowing water down the stairs actually made a difference. Chief Morris refers to it as floating the stairs. You put enough water in the basement, you get water on the floor, you can't have a flashover.
Right.
May not have the best conditions, but at least we know we can make some kind of a push down the stairs if we had no other choice. No exterior entrance getting in, no windows to get any kind of water on the fire. Because that's one thing we have that's big in Stanford is SROs, single room occupancies. So we have a lot of illegal basement apartments where they've chopped up a basement where now, even if you had an exterior access, hey, that might only get you to a mechanical room. It may not gotten you to the illegal apartment on the other side of the basement where there's no access except an interior stairwell that's coming out into a little hallway.
Mm-hmm.
So we really focused on a lot of that, but letting guys see other crews do work and focusing on one task things at a fire has made a huge difference for us. And we've seen it pay off at fires. We're seeing crews just making a big difference, a lot calmer, a lot better, just by doing that live fire training.
Okay.
Big difference. It'd be great if every department could do live fire training every
week. Right.
It does have an impact. And we're not a super busy department. It's not like we're seeing 200 or 300 fires a year. We're probably seeing 100 or less, like, good structure fires.
Right.
Year. So we're not seeing that influx of heavy firework. So we have to make it up somewhere else. And live fire training's really the best way to do it, in my opinion.
Okay. Now, I don't know much about the chief prior to Chief Morris now, but would you say with having an individual such as Chief Morris that is involved with firefighter tactics, up to date with the newest technology and information, having him come in, stepping at the helm, has that benefited Stanford to become a better department?
Yes. In fact, the Monday Fun Days was Chief Morris's push. Right? We talked about live fire training. If we could burn every week, 52 weeks a year, that would be his thing. He is firefighting. Big on skills. And it was funny because everybody's like, well, why aren't we doing searches with the live fire training? Why aren't we doing truck work right away? And Chief Morris's philosophy was, if you can't put the fire out, all that other stuff becomes irrelevant. He's like, we have to have good engine companies that can stretch their line, get the proper line in position, flowing water, and get water on the fire. That's your best bet. The quicker you get water on the fire, more efficiently you get water on fire, everything's going to get better. And that was an Andy Fredericks thing. More people have been saved by a properly placed hose line than any other search company or truck company out there. And that was one of his philosophies, is we have to get good at our job. We have to get the reps in to do that stuff. I mean, no one's going to outwork Chief Morris. The man's work ethic is biblical. But his thing is firefighting, right? He wants you to be very good at your job. He wants you to know your job to the best of your ability. Every day, get out there and do something. It's very hard as a chief because a chief has so many elements to take care of. Personnel issues, new technology coming in, apparatus purchases, budgeting processes. So he's got a lot on his plate, but he's always made the time to focus on the firefighting end of it. Anytime we had a Monday burn, 99% of the time, Chief Morris showed up with his gear on, going in the building.
Hell yeah.
If there's no more leading from the front than that, can't say, hey, I don't feel like going in today because your chief is sitting in the building burning with us. And he's always given, I mean, the wealth of experience he has to bring back to us from New York City in his career in the fire service is invaluable because he has seen, he's been in the busiest companies in the city. So he can relate a lot of the stuff because a lot of the stuff we went over is new to some of our people. Just we don't get the fire load that he saw. I mean, he was working in the city during the war years when the Bronx was burning. So he has that experience to bring back, and he always shares it with everybody. He's not a hoarder of information. He will be out there drilling with you until the sun goes down, and he'll still be there when the sun comes back up. I mean that's it's really nice to have a chief that's focusing on tactics and skills, and he's always about training, always about being the best at your job. He
Love
said, and no one could train more than him.
that. Right. Okay. Respect that.
He's been definitely made a change for that aggressive firefighter. Has definitely helped in that avenue. Definitely made great changes. And it was without yelling at anybody, without making anybody feel like they're insignificant. Because we all know not everybody is going to be your top of the top rank firefighter. We have people from all over, right? We got people down that struggle to get good. You got your core group of people that get their job done, and then you have your people at the top. If we could bring everybody up, you're not going to bring the guy at the bottom all the way up to the top. But if we could bring him up above where he was yesterday, where she was yesterday, you're a much better asset to us than you were the day before. And that's what other people, that's the other thing is people have to focus on their own progress. Don't compare yourself to somebody else. Work on your own progress. If you can make yourself better today than you were yesterday, you're helping the department as a whole.
That's a
Even if it
fact.
has to be little tiny steps. Work on yourself a little bit. Always be open to new information. Don't get stuck in your little bubbles.
Absolutely. Okay. With that being said, with you being a company officer on Rescue One, what kind of leader did you want to be, and what does leadership look like to you?
The big thing is you got to have people want to follow you. I've seen people come and say, hey, I'm the officer. You got to listen to me. You should never have to do that, right? And that's where it takes a lot of hard work. You're not going to walk into an office. People will listen to you because they have to, because they're getting paid to listen to you, but they have to want to follow you. They have to want to be part of what you're doing. So you have to build that respect. You got to understand people have a lot of stuff going on. People a lot of from a lot of different things going on in their life. You can't just shove orders down their throat every day, because at that point, they're going to get burnt out with you. So you got to have the compassion. You got to understand where people are coming from, and understand that everybody is not as hard driver as the top. Usually your officers are seen as the top of the group food chain, or that top 10%, but we all know there's officers that meld in there that weren't necessarily in your top 10%. But you have to build the respect. I mean, we do try to train as much as we can, but you also got to give crews their time to relax and get their time in down there too. But like I said, going back to explaining why did I make that decision? What do I expect at you? You got to set those up. This is why I make decisions. This is what I expect at you. Setting expectations are the biggest thing, because it gives you some kind of barometer to see where your company is. I can't just set super high expectations, and if you don't meet them right away, like, well, what's wrong with you? You got to, okay, well, what's causing you not to meet those expectations? And I actually didn't really learn this much until a couple years ago, when I was still on truck one, had a newer firefighter, great kid, tried to learn, but you could see he was struggling to learn some stuff. And this is where like people's life perspective comes into play, and you got to sort of take your own life experience and perspective and not apply it to somebody else. And I see it happen a lot with truck stuff. You start starting saws, working with saws. Like, how do you not start a saw? How could you have not started a lawnmower or something like that? And you always go with that, because when I grew up as a kid, my father was a mechanic. My grandfather was a butcher. They're both blue collar workers. The 10 years old, I was outside mowing the lawn. My dad taught me how to start the lawnmower. Hey, figure it out from this point on. So my perspective was always like, how do you not know how to start a lawnmower? How do you not start? Because I noticed he was real slow with starting a saw, very like not confident. I'm like, how do you not know this stuff? How do you not know what a Phillips head or a flathead screwdriver is? And it really hit home. He's like, I grew up in the hood. He's like, I was trying to survive.
Right,
He's like,
right.
I didn't mow lawns. He's like, I didn't work on stuff. He's like, I was just trying to make it through every day. And I was like, geez, I never really thought of that. And took it back. Like, I really took it home as like, you can't put your life experiences and match them with somebody else's.
Facts.
You gotta know that maybe they didn't experience what you experienced as a kid. Maybe they didn't have a job where they work with power tools or anything like that. And they were never exposed to it. It's like, I didn't have a lawn to mow. It's like, I never started a lawn. He's like, the first time I started a lawnmower was when we got assigned to the firehouses, and they told us Saturday, hey, you're mowing the lawn. It's like, so you really got to take a step back, because there were times you get frustrated, like, how is this person not working a saw? And he's like, I never really. So he's like, it takes me some more time. He's like, that's why I go so slow. He's like, I'm not sure if I'm doing something right. And I was like, ah, that makes a big change. And people were, and if I'm trying to make you live up to my life's expectations, it may not be the avenue that you came up with. So you got to
Right.
understand there are different walks of life from everybody out there. Maybe some people are not as mechanically inclined as you. Maybe they don't understand what you're trying to teach them right away. So you got to find different avenues of teaching those people. And it was another book I read that made a lot of sense of that is Boyd, John Boyd. I don't know if you read that book about the air combat stuff he did. He lived his whole life frustrated because no one would want to listen to his whole story. And it was either listen to my way or I'm not going to tell you anything about it. And he lived in a lot of conflict with that. So sometimes we got to massage what we're trying to teach and be able to teach it different ways to different people, because they all got to come out and learn something from it. And if they
Right.
could all improve themselves, they'll respect you much more than that. Because I can't get frustrated at that kid because had trouble starting a lawnmower or starting a saw because he didn't have the same experience we all did, or from what I did from that. So you really got to take everybody's a little bit different and learns a little different way. So as an instructor, as an officer, you really got to be able to adapt to that. And if you can't, you might have a hard time having people truly follow you.
Okay. All
So it
right.
comes down to respect on both ends, not just respect for the officer, but that officer's got to respect. We were always taught respect the position. That didn't mean respect the person behind that
That's
position.
right. That's right.
You really got to, and for that to happen, that officer's got to respect his crew. And if you can work both ways, hey, listen, this is why I got upset with that. Or, hey, I was a little stressed out that time. I didn't mean to snap at you, but I was stressed out. But I tend to keep the snaps at the minimum because I work on controlling the heart rate and situational awareness. Those are the skills you really got to focus on. I even tell my guys that, like, no matter how bad a car accident is, you might have to put that emotion aside and keep your situational awareness. We could talk about it after, but right now we got a task to do.
Okay. I love the advice. All right. One of the things you definitely wanted to hit on was spouse preparations. And I think that's one of the items that firefighters tend to forget, whether your spouse, significant other, girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever the case may be, when you're gone, somebody has to run the household, especially if you have children. So I'm going to let you have the floor on that particular topic.
So I really should bring my wife in on this and maybe we'll do another one. But it was really her idea. So when I started the academies, the first academy, we did not do a spouse class. And my wife is like, I really should get my own class. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, I need a class to talk to the spouses about what they're going to experience. And I was like, you really want to do your class? She's like, yeah, you don't even have to pay me. Well, you could pay me in other ways, but it usually involves an Amazon account and her filling the shopping cart and then me hitting buy. She's like, I feel real people really need to have a class. And she went and took a spouse peer support class before this. So she didn't come into it raw. And luckily for me, I met her through my brother-in-law. So her sister is married to another firefighter. So I met her through the fire department, and she was already around her sister who was married 15 years before me. So she saw the fire family life. And when we got married, she asked, she talked, there was a spouse support group that was having a class. She's like, oh, I'm gonna go take that class. I was like, yeah, go ahead, no problem. And there were a lot of firefighters that were against their wives going to that because they thought it was going to be like a gossip circle of like who's talking about the problems with their husband, things like that. And my wife's like, had nothing to do with that at all. You had a couple social workers and psychiatrists come in, psychologists, and they talked about how you can see changes in your spouse. And if they're having PTSD and issues, they could have with that. And sometimes that's your first warning sign. And guys say, well, there should be warning signs at the firehouse. And not necessarily, because maybe everybody at the firehouse is going through different levels of PTSD and they don't notice that in you, or they just discredit it because they don't see it. They said one of the first people that will see problems going on with you, PTSD and issues at work, is your spouse. Because they're going to see that change in you and not know why. And a lot of times they relate a lot of that divorce or issues in the house is to an event that caused you stress. And now you come home and what does your wife do? She dumps, oh, the baby was crying all night. You need to take the baby. And you're like, you need to not give me that stuff right now because I'm trying to decompress from what I just dealt with at work. And then they end up in fights. And then the spouse thinks it's them, and it's really not them. It's something that happened at work. And she's like, wives need that because just as we're coming into the fire service career, that spouse, wife, girlfriend, husband, is coming into that career also, whether they like it or not. But you want to make that transition. You want to give them some knowledge on that transition because it is a big life change. Everybody says, oh, you're just in a career path. I'm like, yeah, I think the fire service, law enforcement is different. It's a lifestyle change. It's not just going to another 9-to-5 job. You're now changing the way you actually work. And she's like, I want to talk to the spouses because she talks to the fire wives and they complain about my husband. I yelled at their husband because they got held over for work in a mandatory holdover, or they're not talking to their husband because they had a fight about something. And she's like, they need to know that there are certain things that are happening. So the second academy, I'm like, well, I talked to the chief. I'm like, is it all right if my wife does a spouse class? He's like, absolutely. And at the time, Chief Roach, he was big into the peer support stuff, dealt with a lot of peer support stuff, believed in firefighter mental health. He had some things go on in his life that he had PTSD, and he did that, the lights and the buzzing and the EMFR, I think it is. so it helped him out a lot. So he was always about firefighter mental health and family mental health too, not just the firefighter. So my wife made the class. We invited all the spouses in. No husbands, no boyfriends, no girlfriends, just the spouses. We didn't want them sitting there. Because like I said, some of the vibe was that the firefighters were like, oh, they're just going to talk about all like, right. the stupid shit we do, and it's going to be embarrassing. Right. And it was, I wanted them to know, number one, I don't want you there to like coerce your spouse into like, oh, don't listen to this, don't listen to that. But number two is nothing about you. It's about the job itself. So we started the class, and we got into the changes in your life. You're going to go from having a kid or no kid or whatever you got, and you got your husband had a regular 9-to-5 job. But now once this academy's over, their first shift, they're gone for 24 hours. There's no turning to your spouse to, well, the kid's having a hard time going to bed. Or the kid's doing this. Or I had this at work. I had a hard day at work. I mean, you have to take care of that kid for 24 hours. And they're away. And you might call them on the phone and they're not going to answer their phone. It's not because they're not ignoring you. It's because they're probably on a call or they're doing something or they're in training or they can't be on the phone. So you can't yell at them for doing that. And she just talked about the psychology of what you're going to have to deal with and building a lifestyle. You need networking. Mm-hmm. You need to have avenues. What happens when a pipe breaks and you can't get a hold of your spouse because they're on a call? Can't turn that into a life fight, right? That's out of their control. They're on a call helping someone else right now. You got to be able to deal with that problem. And let's build a network. Hey, you got other firewives. You got other firefighters you could call. Get friendly with the firefighters that live around you, because if you have an emergency, they're going to come running to help you. They're not just there to help citizens, but we got to help our own family too. But give yourself avenues for being able to take care of stuff when your spouse is away at work. You don't want to have that fight. And same thing with like holdovers and things with the contract. Right? A mandatory holdover, you can't get mad at your firefighter because they're getting held over on Thanksgiving because you had the family coming over. You got to understand that's part of the lifestyle. Don't blame them for that. Don't get mad at them. It's part of the job. That's what we knew what we were getting into from the beginning. And they need to understand that from the spouse end of it. Hey, a day your spouse might come home and not want to talk to you. It's not because they're mad at you. It could be because they had a bad call. And I noticed a lot of firefighters won't tell their wives about a bad day at work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to do that more. You don't have to get into details, but you could say, hey, this was a bad day at work. We had an infant that was in cardiac arrest and didn't make it. It's just not sitting well with me. Because if you just sit at home and be silent, and don't tell your wife anything, she's going to think you're pissed off at her. And then that you really can't take that back. If she doesn't understand what's going on, she's going to start taking it at, like, you're against her or you're mad at her. It could be a perfume that she sprayed, and it could have been the same smell that you smelled at a traumatic car accident that brings back memories on you. I know we had one officer, a captain, so when he saw the color pink, it brought him back to a bad time at a call he had, and he had a hard time dealing with that. So they need to understand that. And if we don't help them get that information before they get there, we're still going to have problems with divorce, still problems. And we don't want problems at home because it's a snowball effect. If that person with PTSD can't get help at home and creates problems at home, that's just going to snowball into other problems, right? Drinking, addiction, suicide, divorce, just all the bad things we don't want to hear people have to go through. And it was a big value. And sometimes she needs to do some coaching because sometimes you hear a wife get upset, like, I'm just overwhelmed with everything. We got kids and he's working again. Well, he's got held over. That's part of the lifestyle. And two, like, if they had a bad day, let them decompress. Hey, I had a bad we had a rough night at work. Now, I know some people probably do that and say, I had a rough night at work every night just to have some peace and quiet. But you should really save that for the days you have hard times. And she's nice because she's like, it educates the spouse that you can't just dump life on your firefighter when they come home from work because it may not be the time. Hey, go take a shower, go to the gym, go do your routine to make you decompress, and then come back to me and we'll handle what's going on at home.
Definitely.
But I know sometimes some people are like, here, I've been waiting 24 hours or 36 hours or 48 hours to give you this problem. Here you go. Take care of it. You're just like, I just had a real bad day.
No, I love the advice. Definitely much needed for other firefighters to hear that and understand that. So I appreciate that.
We kept it fun. Of course, when I talked, it was like not doom and gloom, but I was always the more serious end. My wife would get more of the chuckles and laughs. She's a lot warmer than I am, and a lot of she has a lot more funny quips than I do. So we kept the banter in that way, and we even said, like, hey, you're in the academy right now. We will tell you this, live fire training's going up. Expect your spouse to be a vegetable when they come home because they're going to be exhausted. We're like, you've probably seen it already with physical fitness and doing their little routines that they're already tired. Or like, if we do a full day of live fire training, just don't even expect anything out of them. Just expect them to be a total vegetable because they're totally zapped. If you try to make them like go hang your Christmas lights the day after a live burn, it might not go so well. But they need that education just as much as the firefighters need their education, because you don't want them coming in blindsided to a new career and then all of a sudden resent that their spouse took that career path and they don't know why they hate it so much. They need to be part of that lifestyle. And it's one thing if you're a firefighter before you met your spouse, but a lot of these people are coming in, they're already married with kids, either a career change, and the spouses really like having that education that they know they could go to somebody, know the signs. Hey, you can talk in the fire with, hey, my husband just changed all of a sudden. Hey, maybe you should ask somebody to talk to him. You always get a fire friend. Hey, he's been acting a little different lately. Can you talk to him for me? Or, hey, maybe we should go see somebody. There's a lot of different avenues you could go through. You need to give them that education too. Because the last thing we want to see is have bad relationships, because that's just not good for the fire service also.
Absolutely.
We always tell you to leave your stuff at home, but hold on. Tell you to leave your stuff at home, but at the same time, we got to keep your home nice and orderly too.
That's a fact. That is a fact. Okay. With that being said, I always love to ask the guests and end with this question, and that is, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
That's a good question because I'm sort of in that flux right now.
Okay.
I am on the deputy chief's list. But at the same time, I like where being where I am right now as a captain. I love the position. You're staying in the game. I always feel like when you become a chief, you sort of become separated from the firefighters a little bit. Not saying that's a bad thing, but I'm in that. I still like to go and play. I still like being around the firehouses with the guys. I still like being immersed in the call. Do I want to be a deputy chief? It would be a nice goal to acquire by the end of my career, but I am happy where I am right now. But when I retire, I think I'm going to put more attention on being a grandparent or being part of the family. I don't know if I'll teach after I retire. We'll see where that happens in a couple of years. I got a good another 10 years under my belt before I even think about retirement. But I'll probably focus more on family and doing other stuff than so much the fire service. I know it's part of our lives, but at point two, like, you got to enjoy the rest of your life.
Yes.
Too. And we'll see where it carries me. I like teaching. I do teach on the side too, doing some teaching gigs there. But I'm not like all over the country doing crazy stuff. Or I don't know if I'll have that much of a grasp on it when I retire. Like I said, I want to enjoy the last hopefully 30, 40 years of my life, hanging out with the wife, doing fun stuff, mm-hmm. and having grandchildren and things like that. And I want to focus on that. Fire department will still be a part of my life, but I guess we'll see where the avenues are. Because sometimes I say I'm not going to do anything anymore, and I find myself doing it even more when I say I'm not going to do something.
Right.
But I am happy where I am now. Would not be nice to be a deputy chief because it help. It gets to be some of the final changes you wanted to make in your career with the department, and that's what I always been for. If I can make a little bit of a better change, make people like their job a little better, or be more enthusiastic about doing their job, then I'm happy with that. And I think at a deputy chief spot, you could help make some of the bigger organizational changes from that perspective, where as a company officer, you're sometimes limited to the company that you're working with change. I was fortunate enough to be an academy instructor where I was able to implement a broader change to some of the new recruits. And hopefully over the years, we see that made for a better outcome. It seems to be paying off right now because I always said after I did the first academy, they asked me to do the next two. Then after those two, they asked me to do the fourth one. So I feel like I was doing something right, and we were getting a good product out of that.
Right.
We'll see where the test of time takes it. But there's a great group that I've taught, and I've been blessed to be fortunate where I've gone in the fire service. And we'll see where the future brings. I won't say I won't stay in it. I won't say I'll totally get out. But
right.
I think sometimes our priorities change as we retire.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Be focused on family. For the things that we've missed throughout my career, I can't say you should be missing that when I'm retired.
Mm-hmm.
They paid their dues for the 32 years I would have been here.
Yeah.
So sometimes take that into perspective. And sometimes you can't get out of it. Like I said, Chief Morris, no one's going to outwork him. No one's going to outfire him. And that's his life.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. You know, we need to have individuals stop comparing themselves to individuals like Chief Morris. Like, you have to be your own person. But one thing I like that you said was you love the fire service, but the fire service doesn't define you. It's not just who you are.
No, it isn't who you are. You have to have your own personality too. And then we could get consumed in it.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of people, they retire and they pass away 6 months later.
Yep.
And it's because they had nothing else but the fire service. I've seen guys miserable. I've seen guys get divorced after they retire. I've seen guys just not happy with their lives. And it was because that's all they had was the fire service. And now they're not in that game anymore. It's very hard to leave. It's hard to leave seeing your crew every day coming into work, going on calls, doing the fun stuff, hearing the sirens go. And then when you shut that all off at the end of the day, you need to have some other avenue, some other purpose, right? And it should be family, and it should be enjoying the time. You paid your dues at this point. Don't cash in everything without taking the dividends.
Yes, sir.
See people live the last years of their life unhappy. And I don't want to be that way. I want to enjoy it with my wife. My kids will be grown, hopefully grandkids. And that's where I'll spend my purpose, is making them happy and having good times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right.
Joe, I appreciate you accepting the invite, coming on. I like to give credit when it's due, Clay McGee, for introducing me to you. And I made the contact and we were able to make this happen. Thank you for taking time out of your day to drop some gems and nuggets for those listening. Like, everybody that comes on here has a different perspective, a different way that they've seen the world, but they all bring the same value. Might be worded differently, but it's all the same thing. And the thing I want people to understand is this job, like we talked about, doesn't define you. It is the greatest job in the world, but we have to make sure we have other avenues when it's our time, because unfortunately the fire service, it's going to continue moving with or without you. It's been there before you. It'll be there way after you. So I just want to say thank you for coming on and sharing some light and some knowledge for those that are listening.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.